Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome Bill Hutchison. He is from the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and he is here to talk to us about some marvelous events that are happening this Saturday, the 7th of June. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's very nice to be back here again. So both of these are vehicle-related, and they're very cool. We have two events. It's the second time we've done one, the third time we've done another, and they're so excellent, we just stick them together. One is the Critter Run. That's a motorcycle ride, which you would not believe how many bikers love animals in our community. On Saturday, June 7th, it'll be a poker run, a five-stop poker run starting at Santa Fe Harley-Davidson. You can register.
A poker run?
Poker run. It's so cool. At every stop along the ride, you get given a card. Every bike gets a card. And by the end, you have five cards. And the best hand, of course, wins a fantastic prize.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. There's this whole world that you and I know nothing about that only those who ride the iron steeds understand.
What? Poker dog runs?
The whole motorcycle subculture.
Tell us more about it.
That's everything I know. Everything I know I've now shared with you and our community. The other part is the car show, which we call Motoring for Mutts. And that part is a food drive. And that's at the shelter. If you haven't been at the shelter, we have this enormous center area in the parking area. And we have this car show where everybody in Santa Fe with a cool car, low riders, old-timey cars, old pickup trucks, super fast hot rods, they all show up. The entrance fee for that is a boot, a trunk, a glove box, a luggage rack, a truck bed, whatever, full of animal food. And we collect
all
that.
That's a lot of dog food.
Oh, it is. Last year we got about a ton of food.
A literal ton
of food. And that's a gigantic pile in front of the shelter. And there's awards for the most brought in a car or truck. And I don't know. I haven't got verification. But last year we had a most popular tire contest, which involved a dog taking a big drink outside and then sniffing a number of tires to see which one was, let's say, marked the most often.
And you've got scientists from Los Alamos doing the measurements from that, about that.
Oh, yes. Both quantity and quality measurements.
We're talking here to Bill Hutchison from the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. So this is a great opportunity for people to get involved. So there's a lot of bikers who love their pets. It's kind of hard to take a dog out on your motorcycle, I would think.
I have seen a few dogs in town riding along in sidecars. Not very many of them seem to be backseat riders as often. And I think mostly that the love that bikers have for their animals are because they have to make up for the time they can't travel with them in the car. So it's even fiercer.
The sidecar thing is a great idea. I know three small dogs who live at my house who would love to do that.
You could have like one of those little biplane cockpit things with three little seats in it, and they could all just ride along.
Heck, I should get a sidecar on my car.
That's I don't know if that's going to be the best idea, but I think it would look awesome.
So how do people get involved?
You can, if you want any more information, you can call the shelter 983-4309 and go to extension 270, and Carrie there can give you a lot more info about it. Or you can just show up if you want to go on the Critter Run on Saturday morning, registrations from 10 to 11 at Santa Fe Harley-Davidson. And then the car show, of course, starts at 1, so you can do both. You can do the Critter Run on your bike, come back, grab some lunch at the shelter, and then stick around for the car show.
Bill Hutchison is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Thanks so much for being with us.
A pleasure, as always.
I'd like to welcome Sid Berger. He's the director of the Phillips Library at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts, and Tom Leach. He is a master papermaker and the director of the press at the Palace of the Governors. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us, Mary Charlotte.
Yeah, nice to be here.
And the occasion for our conversation today is the upcoming exhibition Album Amicorum, Gems of Friendship, at the Governor's Gallery on the fourth floor of the Roundhouse here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Tom Leach, tell us about this exhibit and how it came together and what this album Amicorum is.
Well, a few things came together to make this exhibit happen. First, I was invited to curate a marbling exhibit up at a small nonprofit art center in Colorado.
Now, when we say marbling, we're talking about paper marbling.
Right. Paper marbling. It's a technique of decorating paper that goes back hundreds of years to the 1400s at the very least, if not a few centuries before that. And most people are familiar with marbling, first encounter it in the end papers of old books. So when you open your grandfather's volume of Tennyson, you'll see these beautiful swirled marbled patterns.
Right. Go on.
Yeah, so I have been practicing this art form for more than 20 years and have had a number of shows, and I was asked to put together a marbling show up in Colorado, and I thought, well, that's a great idea, but I want to do something different with this and tell a little more about the history of marbling, which excites me as much as the work itself. And so I thought, what is it that makes marbling, you know, really interesting to me? And it's how marbling actually traveled from the Middle East into Europe in the 1400s and 1500s. And it was through these books called Alba Amicorum. Alba is plural for album. So these Alba Amicorum means friendship books. And it was in these books that these exotic papers were collected and passed around, and people in Europe, usually student scholars, would have these books containing these, and it just spread from there, the interest in these papers.
So it's called friendship book. Whom were these friendships between and among?
You know, Sid might be able to address this better, but I would say generally, at least in this period, it was student scholars.
Sid Berger.
Yeah, sure. It was always students who had these little albums. In fact, my brothers and I had them when we were little kids. We would take them at the end of a semester to all of our classmates, and we knew them as autograph albums, but we didn't know that the genre goes back hundreds of years. The owners of them would have their friends put little drawings or sayings, you know, roses are red, violets are blue type things into these albums. But also, some people took them with them on their trips and had friends or recent acquaintances sign them. So you never knew where they would be signed and, you know, and how many people would put their names and artistry into them.
And so they were essentially not what you might call fine art or high artworks. They were practical things for travelers to use.
Yes, but some of the owners of them hired professional artists to illustrate them, and some of the artistry in them is absolutely exquisite. And, of course, small, great miniaturists, painters who worked in small formats would put their art in them, and some of them are world-class art. They're just absolutely gorgeous.
So throughout the history of paper marbling, well, first of all, do we know when and where what the earliest examples are?
Well, the earliest examples of a marbling technique we know of go back to Japan in 12th century, the 1100s, and there was a form of Japanese paper marbling called suminagashi, which means black ink floating, and it was fairly simple of just taking what a calligrapher's black ink would be and touching the brush to the surface of water, and the ink would float into more or less random patterns. Now, whether there is a direct link from that kind of marbling through China along the Silk Road to marbling as it was picked up in Central Asia or the Middle East, we don't know whether someone was trying to imitate what we'd seen or if it had an independent arising.
So it's interesting because they have been used it certainly for many decorative purposes. The end papers of books is probably the most familiar one. Have they, Sid Berger, have they become fine art at some point? They are, in a way, a type of abstract art.
Yes, actually, they were originally secondary to the work that they were used in. In Persia, for example, beautiful artwork would be put onto a sheet that was marbled either the entire sheet was or the edges were marbled. But eventually, the marbling took over as the central phenomenon, the central artistic element. And in the 20th century, there are wonderful, wonderful sheets of marbled paper that are designed as art to be framed and put up on a wall. They're some really beautiful ones.
As someone with a painting background and who was an abstract painter at one point, I just fell into this. I just love the way these things are. It's to me what Jackson Pollock was doing with paint is not that much different than what I'm doing with paint when I'm splashing it onto the surface of water. You know, he was using canvas, I'm using water, but I think some of the same aesthetic feedback and input is there.
Can you tell, now Sid, you are a collector of marbled paper. When you look at a piece, leaving aside the age of the paper and things like that, can you tell, looking at a piece of marbled paper, just from the style of it, you know, who made it, where it's from, things like that?
There are certain patterns that get repeated over the centuries, and those you can't tell. And the patterns are named, nonpareil and bouquet and peacock and so on. Some of those you can't tell when they were made unless you do an examination of the paper or unless you happen to know who the artist was. But certain marblers have their own personal signature in the artwork that they do. So I can look at a sheet maybe by Hikmet Barucigil from Turkey or, Christopher Wyman from Los Angeles, and I can tell for many, many marblers, oh, that's got to be one of his sheets. Some of the marblers have their own particular styles and color palettes and designs, so many of them are identifiable.
Tom Leach, how does one actually marble paper?
Well, it's easier to do than to tell you how to do it, but generally it involves floating color on thickened water. And this is a generalization because a lot of marblers will say, well, that never works, but this is the way it's done in general. Water is thickened with, for the most part, in Europe and the United States, a material called carrageenan, which is a seaweed derivative. In Turkey, they use gum tragacanth. But then your paints, which I work with acrylic paints, but some artists work with watercolor or gouache or hand-ground pigments just suspended in water. And the color is applied to the thickened water. And because of the differences in viscosity, the color floats. It's the same principle as oil and water not mixing. It's just different viscosities. But then once the desired patterns are put down where you want them, then the color is manipulated with different tools. And depending on which tool you use and in which direction, whether you push it, you pull it, and then which sequence the tools are used, the different patterns are created. So then once you've achieved the pattern you want, paper is carefully laid on the surface of the water, and it is picked up like a print, like a monoprint almost. So a skilled marbler can repeat a pattern hundreds of times. No two will ever be exactly alike, but knowing how those patterns have been achieved, it's sort of like a musician playing a riff. You know, they know how to do it, and you just do it over and over. In fact, for me, in my work, I often think of the traditional patterns almost as being like playing the scales. I do that so I know that everything's in tune, everything's working, and then I go on to some more involved or artistic things.
And so, for example, some of the tools that people use is you can drag a comb or a rake along the surface of the water and have a very regular pattern.
Right, and you know, when you say a comb and a rake, they're specifically made for marbling.
Right.
So you haven't gone out to your garden shed and pulled the rake in, although it could be interesting.
I've seen people do it with those kind of hair.
Those very hair picks,
yeah.
Right. Those work, but you can make most people. You can either buy the tools or you can simply build the tools. They're not difficult to construct.
And you can also blow the pigment around through a straw.
Well, yeah, and in suminagashi, the Japanese form, it's more receptive to wafting with air.
Sid Berger, are you yourself a paper marbler?
I've done it many times, but I'm not a good one, so I stick to other forms of paper decoration. I produce two really beautiful sheets over maybe 100 that I've made, so I don't like to consider myself a marbler. But I'm a marbling collector, and I have thousands of sheets of marbled papers.
How did you start collecting?
I was teaching a course in the history of the book, and I was interested in showing my students every phenomenon that had to go into book production. End papers were one. Other kinds of decorated papers, you know, for paper covers and other things, were things that I taught about. So I decided I'd show my students all the different variations, and I figured I would acquire them to show them. Little did I know in my total ignorance that there are thousands and thousands of variations. And every time I saw a sheet that I didn't own one of, I said, I better get that one. Well, since there are no two alike, that means all of them. It was a difficult thing to stop, and so far I haven't stopped. I have said to people, I'll stop collecting it when they stop making it.
Right. Well, I mean, where do you get it? Are there people, are there art dealers? I never even heard of this, who specialize in marbled paper, for example?
There are many art supply stores that have nice selections of decorated papers, but I like to go to the source. I like to get to know the marblers, find out about their techniques, get samples of their papers. There's a directory put out by a woman named Marie Paluoda. It's a directory of marblers, hundreds of names in there. So I've been writing them, calling them, emailing them, and little by little, the collection has outgrown my house.
How do you display them, just out of curiosity?
Oh, I have many of them up on the walls, but of course, there aren't too many palaces large enough to display all of them. I have them in map cases in my basement, and we have lots of people come over to the house, and I just open the drawers and show them one stack of sheets after the other. But we do have maybe 20 or 30 of them up on the walls in the house.
Now, in the decades that you've been collecting, how has paper marbling changed? How has the art changed?
Well, the actual process hasn't. I think there's been more and more of a recognition of marbling as an art in itself, as the primary piece of artwork, not as a secondary one. So while there are still many marblers who do papers for bookbinders, there are now more and more who think of their sheets as individual works of art.
Tom Leach, do you feel that marbled paper as art is respected in the way that monoprints or other prints are?
Well, I think it's becoming that way, and I certainly do my best to educate the public about these things. I have been doing it for more than 20 years. I think in Europe, more and more, it has been a respected art. In the United States, it's I would like to say it's becoming that way. One thing about our exhibit that I noticed is some of the people who were invited to join the exhibit are bookbinders, so maybe their work isn't as, you know, in your face as some of the other people who do practice this as an art form.
I would like to add something. I think Tom is right that in Europe it's more appreciated as an art form than it is in this country, and it is getting more and more recognized as art. I am involved in a group of paper aficionados, including librarians, archivists, practitioners of paper decoration of all kinds. We had meetings over the last 5 years in Leipzig, Germany, and more than 20 people will show up at these meetings, all of them knowing about the beauties of marbled paper and talking about who does what and recommending, oh, you must see the work of so-and-so. We don't have that kind of gathering in this country yet. I think someday we may, but there's a tremendous body of people in Europe who are really clued into and focusing on marbling as a wonderful art.
Well, Sid, I would like to address the idea of marblers' gatherings, because there actually have been four or five, I can't remember which, international marblers' gatherings. And as it turns out, the very first one happened here in Santa Fe in 1989. And it was billed as the largest gathering of marblers in the universe, because in fact it was. You know, this was an art form, and Sid knows this, that was practiced virtually in secret for hundreds of years. So in, you know, since the 1960s and 70s, the entire sort of ethic of marbling has changed. So rather than secrecy, the idea for artists is to share and get their ideas and techniques out. And because of that, I think you have had this renaissance. So you know, we've had this gathering. The first one was in Santa Fe. A few years later, San Francisco. The last one was in Istanbul in 1997.
The exhibition is called Album Amicorum, Gems of Friendship in a Frightened World. Tell us the frightened world thing that you're...
Well, that's the other part of you know, how this came to be, because as I was pondering how, you know, what this exhibit would be about, I was invited, or I guess assigned by the museum, to accompany a Friends of the Palace trip to Turkey. And it was a great opportunity to go back and rekindle friendships with artists I had met 10 years ago. Well, when we were on the trip, if you will remember last November, October and November, there was an awful lot of headline news about protests in Turkey against the U.S., and the U.S. was putting pressure on Turkey not to invade northern Iraq, to go after the PKK, and there is just a lot of turmoil. And I was getting phone calls and emails from people at home. Are you okay? Are you safe? And yes, we were safe. We wouldn't have thought anything was going on. And it pointed out to me, you know, what's going on in the world is everybody's worried about the Middle East, and there's just an awful lot of fear. This is a place that was once thought of sort of with inspiration as a place of peace. And so I got to thinking about the background of Alba Amicorum, how it was really an early international art form. And I thought, what is the 21st century version of this? And I thought, well, it would be something that would involve the internet. So I thought, let's just start an exhibit. I'll invite one artist, and the only rule with this is the artist has to invite another artist in another country. And so it turned out we ended up with 21 artists from 14 countries around the world in this invitation. I had all the artists online within a month.
Now, there's going to be a couple of other programs. On the 8th of June, Sid Berger is going to be here in Santa Fe giving a lecture called The Magic of Marbled Papers, and that's at 2 o'clock at the Museum of International Folk Art Auditorium, sponsored by the Palace Press. And then there's going to be paper marbling, demonstrations on the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Saturdays of June and July in the courtyard of the Palace of the Governors. Tom, are you going to be demonstrating?
That'll be me, yes.
Are people going to be able to actually make their own, get their hands dirty?
I had intended not, but two of the events at the very least coincide with other Palace of the Governors events. We have the Gem and Mineral Show, so I'll be doing stone pattern marbling for that, and then Spanish Colonial Day, so we'll be making Spanish wave papers. But I think if people come, they'll at least get to try a little bit of hands-on.
Sid Berger, is there anything that you would like to add before we go?
First of all, I think that marbling is such a... I use the word magic in my talk's title because there is a great deal of magic in it, and if people really want to know why, come listen to me talk. But there's such an unbelievable beauty and variety in the artistry of these marblers that you can't believe your eyes. I have had dozens and even hundreds of people over to my home, and I pull out certain sheets, and everyone gasps when they see one. Oh, that's the most beautiful sheet I've ever seen. And then the next one I take out, they say the same thing for. And that can go on for about a half a day. People really ought to know about it. It's infectious. We had an exhibit of one marbler at a museum. Well, it's an art gallery in Santa Monica several years ago. Her name was Carly Frigga, perhaps the best marbler in the world, though I don't, you know, I shouldn't say that in front of Tom because he's one of the top in the world, too. But we had 14 of her pieces in the exhibit, and people were fighting to buy them. They all wanted to get them instantly. And that was just one form of her marbling, and there are thousands and thousands of sheets out there that are of equal beauty and mystery. So I think, you know, marbling has become almost like a cult underground form of art, and we're trying to get it less underground and more public by the exhibit that Thomas put on.
Yeah, I would just like to second that some of the artists in the exhibit are, like Carly is in the exhibit. There are a few other people who I would say are really right up there as the best. And so that's what was exciting to me, because when I launched this, I had no idea who the artists would be who would be invited. And because it was basically self-curated by the artists, and we ended up with some really great people. It was a lot of fun to see that.
Right. Another thing to point out is that when people go see the exhibit, they'll also see paste papers made from paste that has been colored and spread over sheets of paper and then manipulated in certain ways to create patterns. Also, another magical form of paper art. And there is no end to the artistry you'll find in these papers. I have thousands of them at home. I give workshops in paste paper decoration, and people who are not artists at all come in and produce gorgeous, wonderful papers.
Paste papers are very much akin to finger painting.
Right, similar to it, but different in some ways, but surely.
Sid Berger is the director of the Phillips Library at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts, and Tom Leach is a master papermaker, marbler, and director of the press at the Palace of the Governors. The exhibition album Almacorum, Gems of Friendship in a Frightened World, will take place from June 6th to August 31st, and Sid Berger is giving a lecture on the 8th of June. For more information on any of this, please call 476-5096.
And we have a website now for Album Almacorum, if I may tell you that. It's palaceofthegovernors.org/album.
Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's been
Thank
fun.
You.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'd like to welcome Craig Barnes, writer, and Clara Soyster, director of the new play, The Last Tudor, The Fascinating Mystery of the Virgin Queen's Heir, being presented by the Red Thread Collective at El Museo Cultural in Santa Fe, starting on June 6th and running through June 22nd, Thursday through Sundays. Welcome, Craig and Clara, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, Craig, let's talk about this. First of all, Queen Elizabeth, 16th century queen. How did you choose her for the subject of your play?
Well, she's been the subject of three plays, and this is the last in the trilogy. This is at the end of her life. And this is a time when we really see the arrogance of power. We really see the fragility of power, the erratic nature of the old lady when she gets to the end of her life. And it's not much talked about. Everybody knows about the icon queen, the glamorous young dancing, singing, having fun running with a stag's queen. But not very many people know about what happens when you have a lot of power for all your life, and whose hands you cut off and whose necks you cut off and things like that. And all of that is actually pretty important for the issues of today, which is how much power do you give people and what happens to them when they get it.
So set up the plot for us.
This is a story about the queen when she is desperate at the end of her life looking for a successor who is not the Scottish dolt, who James I of Scotland at that time was not a very clever fellow. And he was in line, and the queen needs to find somebody who is not so inadequate, not so incompetent. And then we find, and this is supposed to be, of course, to be the Virgin Queen, but we find out that she's had some very handsome courtiers sleeping next to her for many years. And there is an issue of why she goes to the country all the time and sometimes has stomach aches and retires for months at a time. And so at the end of her life, did she in fact have a child? And if she did, what was his role in life and what happened to him? And there is a painting of her in her young years looking very pregnant. So there is a painting by the court painter of that time. So these pieces fit together, and we say to them, now what would have happened had she been looking for that son?
Now, is this an orthodox historical interpretation?
Nothing.
I can't
remember the last time I did something orthodox.
I can't either. But I mean, do people say, "Oh yes, Queen Elizabeth had illegitimate children"?
No, people do not say that. And of course, it's historically or officially, very bad news. A patriarchy is not supposed to have unknown children. You got to know who's in line with who, and that's the whole foundation of patriarchy. So this would have been very bad news and very politically dangerous for both the son or the daughter and the queen herself, had it been known. This portrait that hangs in the Hampton Court Palace for many, many years had the plaque on the bottom of it that said Queen Elizabeth. And just in the last 4 or 5 years, they've taken that plaque off and call it now an unknown woman, an unknown, quite obviously pregnant woman. Bright red hair, the Tudor rose all over her brocaded gown, golden gown. She's got a lament in the picture that says, oh, my God, what terrible life I've led and how awful this is. And there she is.
So why didn't she marry and have heirs?
Because of the danger of it. Any time a queen, queens were not very customary. There had only been one before in English history, her sister. And if a husband came in, he was very likely to take over. She didn't want a husband to take over. And if she had a son, the history was that sons would push mothers out of place. So either of those were quite dangerous for her. And I think she enjoyed power. She enjoyed ruling without having to fuss around with somebody who contested her points of view. She had absolute power. One of the very interesting things about this queen is that she used the royal prerogative to dispense with laws, suspend the laws of the parliament, and do whatever she wanted to do, and she got away with it. She's the last absolute monarch in English history.
What were some of the things that she actually did? When we talk about in the United States right now, for example, rewriting laws and so on, you think of signing statements.
Exactly right. Yes.
President George Bush does to actually undercut the law that was just passed and that he just signed. I guess it was more extreme than that in 16th century England.
Well, it was in some cases more exactly the point, and that's one of the reasons why the play is written, is in order to use old examples for new abuses. And George Bush is doing it very much the way Queen Elizabeth did, so that for him to say, I'm not going to pay attention to the courts, I'm not going to pay attention to the legislature, is exactly what Queen Elizabeth did. And she said her prerogative came from God. And since it came from God, she could do whatever she would. And she would take a fellow who said that she had the power to establish order in the kingdom and execute him because he didn't say she had the power to establish, confirm, continue, and perpetuate the power. She didn't use enough verbs to satisfy her. And a poor fellow by the name of Prynne or Penry lost his head because he had a little, he'd printed a pamphlet some years before and it was past the statute of limitations, but he had a little scrap of paper in his pocket. The pocket said the queen established laws, not enough, off of their head. So quite brutal, quite brutal.
Quite brutal indeed.
Yeah, yeah.
So not enough verbs.
Not enough verbs to say what the queen's power was.
So why was the queen so insecure about her power? Were there challenges to it happening regularly?
There had been. There were a great many challenges. The Pope had excommunicated her and asked her to be sent so-called papist agents on shore to assassinate her. They made several attempts during her life to assassinate her. There were various. There was a huge controversy between the Catholics and the Protestants or the Anglicans to try to gain control of the throne, and she was constantly in danger. That was a fact. Yeah.
So, how should we say this? Because this comes up in your play. What was the nature of the social hierarchy in 16th century England?
Queen was at the top. Everybody swirled around her trying to get as close to her as they could. They called them courtiers, and the courtiers would try to bless her with flattery. She gave to them one by one patents for everything from straw to hay to sugar to salt to saltpeter to wine. She gave them all patents and in that gave them a monopolies. So that the hierarchy of power, the economic power, was according to her distribution of these patents to monopolies. And she could manipulate those one way or another. And of course, this was havoc in the English economy because you can't very well compete, and you can't keep prices down, and there were all kinds of problems with these monopolies. But that's how she maintained her power.
What kind of advisors did she have around her? I mean, she wasn't making decisions about what to do in a vacuum.
She had these elaborately rich people who favored her with flattery on the one hand, and in some cases had some pretty good advice, people like Lord Burghley and his son Cecil, who is in our play. Lord Cecil becomes the kind of demonic evil fella in our play because he was only interested in power. But she assembled a collection of fairly decent advisors. One of the people in our play is the Earl of Essex, who was, in fact, in her life, too. And he loved to flatter the Queen. He'd been quite a great, brave soldier. But she didn't, and he was 20, he was 30, and she was 65 or 70. She was, but he treated her like a lover. She treated him like a lover. And it got pretty hot. But when he couldn't compete with Cecil, he decided to have a little rebellion. So he went to London, assembled 200 people, marched on the palace, didn't make it, and lost his head. So those were the days when, and these guys, of course, we have this little rebellion in our play, The Last Tudor. So we get to see what happens to fellas who do that, and then we have a sort of surprise ending.
Now, I would think being an advisor to the Queen would be like walking on eggs, because at any time, if you say the wrong thing, particularly if you just say the truth, you might be decapitated.
Exactly right. And so whenever the Queen looked your way, you were supposed to get down on your knees. Or if you were speaking to her, you were supposed to get down on your knees. So there was you know, bobbing up and down was going on all the time. And in our play, we get around that with the introduction of the court jester, the court fool, who can tease and make riddles and rhymes out of the truth and try to tell her England is divided into two parts, but he'll say it in Latin. Anglia is divisa in partes due, which is a play on Caesar's all of Gaul is divided into three parts. So he can do those. He can do things in Latin. He can do things in rhyme and rhythm, in order to tell her the truth, and save his head. But he's quite alert all the way through that his head is in danger.
Do we have to know Latin to see your play?
There's that one line. You've just heard it. You've just heard it.
We're talking to Craig Barnes and Clara Soyster. Now, you are the director, Clara, of a play that's written kind of in Elizabethan English?
Yeah, kind of in Elizabethan English. I call it Shakespearean undertones or overtones or a little of both. So, yes, and so there's a rhythm that you find with it. Craig writes in a particular rhythm. So part of it is finding that rhythm in the speech and letting the actors find that. And fortunately, we have some actors that are well trained in Shakespeare, and several from the old Shakespeare Santa Fe.
Have you directed Shakespeare as well?
I have, but it's been a little while. Twelfth Night was when I had directed.
One of the things, and actually you talked about this, Craig, the other day when we were having a conversation, how one of your teachers asked you to explain when you were in school, what the five plots were in The Merchant of Venice.
That's right.
And therefore you thought that all plays need to have five plots.
Well, all plays in the Shakespearean month. It was the eighth grade. I remember I was sitting in the second desk from the front, and this fellow stood up, Mr. Hansen was his name, he stood up and said, what are the five plots in The Merchant of Venice? Well, we all stumbled around in the eighth grade. But it seems to me that a Shakespearean play ought to have five plots, so we've got about five in here.
Yeah, we do. Now, that explains a lot. I didn't know that story. Now, that explains so much.
We've got a plot. We've got a lost ring plot. We've got a ring that comes back. We've got a bar scene plot. We've got a love romance plot. We've got the succession to the throne plot.
Yeah.
You've got to have a little mystery and intrigue. You can get people interested in the 16th century.
Well, after you've talked about how brutal Queen Elizabeth was, talk about the phenomenon that happened in Shakespeare, where you have a playwright actually writing about royalty as human beings.
It's an extraordinary thing that happens in this most absolute of all reigns, where she could take people's heads just by nodding or sending them to Star Chamber. And what way was there? What possible way would there be to speak truth to the Queen or speak truth to the fragility of power? And the way was through theater. And Shakespeare's use of lines as in Richard II, for you have but mistook me all this while, I eat bread like you, taste grief, need friends. That's a humility that Queen Elizabeth never showed. Or when he took apart Henry VI and made him look like a bumbler, that was a disrobing of a king that the queen would not have allowed, or Coriolanus or Caesar. Or Richard III, which, you know, was a brutal, in Shakespeare's eyes, a brutal power-seeking film. The only way you could do it was in these histories and through this indirect method of making them seem human. But what happened was that was so critical, so fundamental, that when her reign came to an end in 1603, the next people were up against the fact that they weren't considered as divine as she. Shakespeare and Marlowe and Ben Jonson had disrobed royalty for the first time in English history and created the foundation that eventually resulted in the American Constitution.
So say more about that. It's because human beings were that kings and queens were perceived by the general populace through the medium of art as human beings that the political situation actually changed and the divine right of kings was challenged?
Exactly right. That here come these plays, and there are 37 Shakespeare plays, and at least 6 or 7 or 8 of them question the divinity, the next to godness of the royal power. And that's the first time that that's happened. So James I does come along after Elizabeth, and he claims it, and his son claims it, and lawyers start to stand up in English court and say, are you kidding? You know, what about habeas corpus? What about due process? Well, says the king, I've got it direct from God. Well, yeah, but so they've got this empowerment because there's been somebody who said, have the king say, I eat bread like you, taste grief, need friends. Well, all of a sudden, this is not just a spokesperson for God. This is a human being. And that unraveling of the divinity of the king takes place for 50 years in English in that next century, in the following century. Comes to the point where James II in 1689 says, I can undo the laws just like Elizabeth do. I can do what I want with the laws just like Elizabeth did, and I can take people's heads like Elizabeth did. And by that time, the Parliament has become infused with this idea that that's too much, and they say, you're out of here. And that, tossing that king out, was the memory that the writers of the American Constitution had. They read about it, they knew about it, and they said, oh, wait a minute. You do not. And so our oath of office in the American Constitution says that a president, and it's in the Constitution, shall faithfully execute the laws. That's not just a throwaway line. Faithfully execute is different than dispensing with or suspending the laws that the kings had done. So what they're saying in the Constitution is, no. When we have a president, we're going to have somebody who does faithfully execute the law, which brings us to the point you made earlier. Now we've got a president who acts like a king signing statements that says, you know, I'll do it if it doesn't interfere with my powers as commander-in-chief. Well, here we go. Mm-hmm. We're right back to a president who thinks himself a king.
It does really bring up the whole issue of how our daily lives and our thoughts are really determined and lived according to the rules and to the big ideas that surround us.
Stories tell us what we spend our money on, where we put our attention. And these stories of the glory of Elizabeth or the glory of the American Constitution, and those are two different stories, are very much at issue in the American conscience, American culture today. So what Claire and I are doing is reviving some sense of the significance of people who, the hero in our play is the court jester. And the court jester, it looks like a simpleton, and is in fact the common man, the common woman upon whom history depends.
So this is an interesting challenge for you, is taking a play set in another time, mm-hmm. but that's modern and sort of making it coherent. I mean, how are you doing that?
Well, the main thing for me when I read the play that really appealed to me was the human side of these people. So that's what I focus on rather than the history. The history's there, and everyone knows the history to a great extent. But I looked at these people like the queen and thought, well, what is her journey from being a queen to being a human being, to being a woman, to being a mother. And then we looked at each character that way, and I said, well, what's the journey of the fool? And the same thing, what masks does he have to wear, and where do those come off? And as they come off, who is underneath? Who's the man underneath? And there's themes that, of course, Craig has woven in, lines that are you'll recognize from the headlines today, that when Cecil is wielding his power as sort of this, I call him sort of the CIA KGB of the court, and how he treats people and how he has an absolute idea of how things happen and nothing is going to get in his way. So we have sort of, everyone's almost their own archetype as well, because we have 11 people representing a huge spectrum of the population and of ideas. So it's their condensed versions, each of them holding their own. I look at each of them as, who are you representing? What are you representing? And going from there. So to me, it's getting the humanness across.
Now, are you having people do English accents?
Yes. That was a request from Craig, and fortunately, all of these actors are very well trained. They're wonderful. I'm astonished every day at the quality, and so that's an easy thing. And plus, there is a lovely thing that happens with English accents is it's easier to play a particular.
It's easier to get in character.
Character for one, and then also where they are status wise in this. You know, lower class, upper class, middle class, and all the different ones in between.
Because each one has its own separate accent.
So when you're in the tavern with the old soldiers, you know that these fellas are not courtiers by any means. But then when you get into court, there's even the different levels. And Santiago himself, there's some question of his background. And is he, you know, his background to some degree we know is from Spain, so he has a slight hint of that. But there's so many other things mixed in his character that keeps him a mystery, I think. That's quite nice.
He's the court jester fool who becomes the hero.
Yeah.
So on Thursday the 5th, there is an opening night?
There is a kind of a dress rehearsal, last dress rehearsal performance for a benefit, for some worthy people to be benefited. And the real opening night is the June 6th. The gala is June 6th. We will have what do you call this, jugglers and harps playing and flutes playing, and we'll have oranges and food and all kinds of fun.
And all of this is happening at El Museo Cultural, and then the play, The Last Tudor, The Fascinating Mystery of the Virgin Queen's Heir, runs through June 22nd, and it's Thursdays through Sundays. For more information, people can call 455-2340. Craig Barnes is the playwright, and Clara Soyster is the director of the play. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.